You still don't remember a thing.
I don't remember any of it.
I only remember the interpreter. Why he wants this job?
I need the money.
Don't disappoint and turn out to be a pain in the ass.
No, not me, sir.
Money isn't the reason he wants this job.
It's Alabama killed his son.
Stop the vehicle, Sergeant.
We don't want to go down this road.
You're out of your bounds, Ahmed. You're here to translate.
Actually, I'm here to interpret.
Welcome to the Subbeacon Podcast. I'm your co-host, Mike Warren. Joining me, of course, are my two co-hosts, Jonathan V. Last and Sonny Bunch. You can find us at subbeacon.com, where you can listen, subscribe, comment, tell us what you think of the show. In this week's episode, we will be discussing Guy Ritchie's The Covenant. Guy Ritchie's The Covenant. But first, let's hear how everyone's doing. Jonathan, what's going on, man?
So I was just telling Sonny before we went on the air, I'm a little bit nervous about the show because I think it's going to border on politics for a little bit. And so I'm just going to lean into that. And I would like to talk with you guys about a bill currently making its way through the North Carolina legislature in which three Republicans are attempting to ban participation trophies in all sports. Now, how the enforcement of this would work is unclear. It's unclear if they have to deputize a posse showing up at every single Little League game or peewee soccer game in the state to make sure that nobody handed out a participation trophy, or what they would do if somebody did. But I was curious as to what, since all three of us now are involved in youth sports, do you see a lot of like mollycoddling and participation trophy stuff? Because on my own, we're all hostage to our own experiences. I do not. And what I've seen is the opposite problem, which is that everybody has to start doing super serious club and travel teams by age 7. Otherwise, they have no chance of even making their middle school team. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I was the participation trophy generation as a mid-generation millennial. I feel like I had a whole, like, a part of my room that was just like stuffed with participation trophies. And
that's amazing. I never got a single trophy,
but like
for anything,
but of course they didn't mean anything because I like everybody got one. What was meaningful?
Did they mean something to like 7-year old you?
No.
Like, were you proud of them?
No. Here's what meant something to me was what the coach said at the party at Pizza Hut as he handed you the trophy. You know, for me, it was, you know, because I was not a very good athlete, shocker to anybody who knows me. It was always most improved. You know, that was always the sort of appellation I got. But, you know, a good coach would say something, you know, like what Michael did here. Well, it was Michael W. because I was on a baseball team 1 year that had 6 Michaels on it.
I was going to say 5 different Michaels.
Actually, I was Michael Bob because all of us were Michael. And so we all went by our middle names. And so my middle name is Robert. So I was Michael Bob, and there was Michael Patty. There was Michael George.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, it was that sort of, this year, you know, this season, he came in and really every day at practice really put in his all, you know, all that sort of thing. That was what I sort of felt made me feel good. Not the trophy. The trophy was like, oh, okay. But I will say that my kids don't get trophies. They might get like a medal, like a little medal on a string for some of the sports they play. But the trophy thing is not, at least in our little league and our little soccer league as well, has not been a thing. And they don't miss it. They don't care.
Well, they don't know that they're missing it, right? Sonny, how is it with you? When you were coaching just a few short months ago, did you give out trophies to your young players, your young athletes?
Well, this is a complicated question. It's a complicated question because in theory, that's what should have happened. In theory, the YMCA gives us a box of trophies and we distribute it at the last game of the year. But the problem with our league was...
Wait, hold on. Let me guess. You took the kids together after the final game with the box of trophies. And you said, I'm supposed to give these trophies to you, but none of you earned it. And then you dumped the box into a trash can. And then you threw it on the floor, and then you started berating them. You got up in their faces with spittle in the fingers and say, and you, Madison, you didn't try at all. You're a terrible soccer player. You, Genevieve, you make me sick. Brandon, why weren't you on the bag? Get on the damn bag, Brandon.
Well, it was soccer, not baseball, but yeah. Same basic idea. No, so we were supposed to get the trophies at the last game. You get them at the last game and you hand them out, right? Oh. Except our last game was rained out 2 weeks in a row, so they didn't have a last game.
Oh.
So then it is, then there's a question of how to get. So in theory, what could have happened was I would have gone to the YMCA, I would have gotten the trophies, and then we would have all gotten together for, at Cece's Pizza or whatever, and we would have had a little pizza party and it would have been great. So I emailed all the parents. I said, "Hey, I'm gonna go get the trophies. Where do we want to do, a little get together at the end of the year?" Zero of them emailed me back. Zero of the parents emailed me back. So we just didn't give out trophies. Nobody got any trophies. There were no trophies, no medals, nothing of that nature. Given
or did
out.
It mean that the bunch child got all of the trophies?
That he got no trophies either because I just didn't go pick him up. I literally just never went to pick them up because I didn't hear from any of the parents. So I was like, oh, fuck it. If they don't care, I don't care. I literally don't care. I don't care at all. I'm not going to I'm not going to struggle to get these things distributed to the kids if the parents don't care. And I heard back from zero of them. I got zero emails back. So I was just like, ah, fuck it. We're done with soccer's over. Soccer's over. I hope you had a good season, kids. We're all done. So in theory, they would have gotten the participation trophies, but because nobody cared enough to get the participation trophies, there were no participation trophies given out. So that's how I prefer it. I didn't really want to have to do.
It's an end of season miracle.
Anyway, it all worked out for me. It was less stuff I had to do.
You didn't
want
to have to think of something that they each did right and tell them, you were most improved.
But see, I thought that was a nice thing, and maybe because I sucked, is I thought it was a nice thing growing up. But, you get a relationship with these kids over the course of a season. You do see them grow, or you sort of have a problem kid, who never listens. And then by the end of the season, maybe they do something that surprises you. And,
it's all bad news bears. They're all shitty the whole time and nobody learns any lessons.
Okay.
That's how it really is in the real world.
Okay. Well then
in the real world, not in your Pollyanna 1990s hazy memory of childhood, yeah. Mike Warren, but yeah. In the real world,
well, can I just say
it's all bad and it stays bad forever.
Can I just say the whole participation trophy complaint? First of all, I've only heard boomers complain about it. Mm-hmm. And yet I think who bought the participation trophies for us? Ooh. Who was the one? Who were the people? It wasn't 7-year-old me going, can I please? I didn't know what a trophy was. I didn't know what a participation trophy was. So, physicians heal thyself. That's all I have to say.
I definitely had participation trophies because you just got them at the end of the season or whatever. But I didn't care about them. The trophies I cared, I had actual trophies that I won at various taekwondo tournaments in sparring.
What?
In form presentation.
What?
Yeah, I was a black belt in taekwondo growing up. I was the American taekwondo.
Are you shitting me?
Stop. No, everything.
I am learning new layers of the bunch onion.
Yes.
My hands are registered weapons.
Your body is a lethal weapon.
I'm a registered weapon in 17 different states because of my first degree black belt from the American Taekwondo Association.
So, I have to ask, is the first degree black belt, so what age were you when you achieved your first degree black belt?
Oh, God, how old was I? I must have been Let's see. I got the black belt after we had moved to Virginia, so I must have been 13, 12 or 13, something like that.
So is the black belt that one gets as a 12 or 13-year-old the same mastery equivalent to a black belt that one would get as a 30-year-old?
Well, it's like Kramer.
Black
it's
belt
like,
is black belt.
It's like Kramer and Seinfeld. You're all the same level. Yellow belts.
Right.
If you're a 45-year-old yellow belt or a 8-year-old yellow belt, it's the same. It's the same. So my 13-year-old black belt would was no. It's very funny. I mean, look, you had folks in the class who like there was an age range, and there were like older, like more accomplished athletes, more like actual athletes who were also like getting their black belt at the same time. And sometimes we would like it almost for fun. It would be like, all right, Sonny, you go up against the, you know, 22-year-old Marine.
And, oh. like,
and that was always fun. But
would
no
you spar.
But it was always like, I mean, it's a very controlled, it's not like Cobra Kai, you know, it's not like there's not a lot of leg sweeping. Or that sort of thing. But at the tournaments, you were broken down by belt, but also age range. It was like, you know, it was like brown belt from age 10 to 12 or some, you know, the range was fairly narrow. So
cause the
was,
size thing does make a difference.
No, it makes a huge difference. Makes a huge difference. But I mean,
why did you give it all up? Did you achieve everything you wanted to achieve in the sport?
Yeah, I got my black belt and then I was like, I'm, you know, I can defend myself against, you know, the marauding bullies. Nobody's raping me in an alley. I'll tell you that right now. I don't even need a whistle. I got my front kicks and my. But no, I mean, I was like, I could probably still break a board. I bet I could break a board. It's not hard. It's not. It's you just good form. You just snap that wrist. Pop. Snap that wrist.
Like the three ninjas.
This is amazing.
I know.
How did I never know this about you?
Well, I don't talk about it a lot because I don't want people to know. I want people to think they've got the drop on me. I want them to be like, oh, look at this fat beardo.
So you're afraid that people are going to...
And his glasses.
People are going to see it as a challenge. They're going to say, I got to go take a shot at Sonny Bunch.
You're just sick of that. I don't want to be in a situation where everyone thinks I'm the toughest guy in the prison yard and they gotta take me down. Because, again, if I start killing people all over the place, it's like Con Air. I'm going to be in jail with Cyrus the virus, and it's going to be a real problem for me. I don't want to go to jail.
It's about protecting everyone else, JVL.
I'm samurai
thinking
code,
about the
Ronin.
The newspaper publisher's bodyguard and the gentleman when they, you know, the van of guys pulls up and is like, yeah, you're coming with us. And he's like, I know karate. He just backs away. He's like, I'm sorry, boss.
This is going to sound extremely ignorant. What distinguishes from the in the specific moves or style taekwondo from karate?
You're gonna ask a question here I don't know the answer to. My basic understanding is that these are all like various nationalities. So taekwondo is mostly Korean, I think.
Right.
Taekwondo is mostly Korean. The American Taekwondo Association was founded by this South Korean guy, and like there's a South Korean flag in the studios.
Right.
And anyway, and karate is, you know, is I guess Japanese.
Yeah,
I don't
right.
know. Chinese,
but like,
I don't know.
But would like, I be able to? It's would I be able?
Oh,
to,
like, there's no difference.
Well, no, there. But like, there are different fighting style. I mean, like, think of a Kill Bill, right? There are different fighting styles. But I couldn't possibly sit here and break them down for you. I couldn't. If you had like two martial artists fighting in a room, I could be like, oh, that guy's doing jiu-jitsu. Everybody else is doing taekwondo or karate or something. I don't know. Like, jiu-jitsu is the only one I would actually recognize as an actual distinct art form because it's a lot of grappling, you know, more so than taekwondo or karate, which is a lot of just striking and kicking.
Right. Jiu-jitsu is you use your opponent's moves against them.
Yeah, and again, it's like a lot of, you're getting in close and like
right.
grabbing, you know, it's not, anyway. I am by no means, we're talking like 26, 27 years ago now. So it's been a minute since I've since I've practiced martial arts on a semi-professional, you know, touring the nation, doing winning many tournaments, amassing rooms of trophies.
Not participation trophies for Sonny Bunch. Those no were participation earned.
Every once in a while, I would go to a tournament and I would not place in either form or sparring, and I would go home and I would put myself in the Kill Bill coffin and punch my way out.
I was gonna say, would you go out, you know, in the bad part of town then, like Mr. Nobody, just looking for troubles, so you could beat on people and catch your frustrations?
Exactly. I mean,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hijack our show with this question, but it's taken us in interesting directions. Mike, isn't this exciting?
I'm excited. I'm on the edge of my seat. But I feel like I'm going to be let down because I'm going to ask Sonny how his weekend was. And if it's not him doing Taekwondo, which I know it's not, then it's just going to be a letdown.
No, my dog's shitting everywhere. This is a problem we've actually already fixed. But the I may have mentioned that, like, dogs can get COVID. Did I tell you guys this?
No.
When I was talking about getting COVID, apparently dogs can get COVID. And I don't know if my dog got COVID, but when I had COVID, the dog was not isolated from me, as apparently you are supposed to isolate the canine in your life. And for like a week after I had COVID, the dog was getting up in the middle of the night and just like kind of pooping everywhere. Just pooping all over the floor. So that was annoying. We took her to the vet, and the vet was like, it's probably not COVID. It's more likely to be Giardia or something like that. Apparently Giardia is going around right now. Do you know what Giardia is? Giardia is a little microbe that gets in your, it kills people. It's a bad thing. But dogs are a little bit more resilient, I think, because they just eat stuff off the ground all the time. And if they died anytime they ate a disease ridden fungus or whatever, they would not be long for this world. So anyway, but that was either my dog either had COVID, which gave her the runs, or possibly Giardia, or something else. Anyway, she is taking a series of medicines and is now feeling much better. But just want more proof in JVL's anti-dog.
Yeah, that's disgusting.
All I hear is the world. This is why you shouldn't own a dog.
I like having a dog, but it has been it's been a real pain in the butt the last like 6 months or so.
So to speak.
So anyway, that's what's going on. That's all that's going on with me. Just dog pooping everywhere. I don't really have anything. I'm almost done with Resident Evil 4, the Resident Evil 4 remake. Real exciting time in my life.
So there's really nothing going on in your life, is what you're saying.
It's really nothing.
Got it.
Really. One thing I will say, I don't know. I don't actually know if any tickets will be left by the time we tape this episode. But we've got one of the many other shows that I do across the movie aisle. We're doing a live show at the Crystal City Alamo Drafthouse. We're there for a screening of War Games. We're going to do a show afterwards. It's like the apocalyptic moment in 1980 cinema, which is an interesting kind of thing. JVL, you said that War Games gave you nightmares as a child.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely terrifying.
It was terrifying because of the Quakers.
Well, we talked a lot about nuclear war at Quaker school. And the library was packed full of books about nuclear war. And it was a constant subject, and there was, you know, if that crazy Reagan wins, we're going to have a nuclear war, everybody, so you should get ready for that. Like, what? People, they're like, yeah, he's elected president, there will be nuclear war. I remember asking, I was like, do people know this? And the teacher's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, they know it. I'm like, then who's going to fucking vote for him? That's insane.
I think grown-ups in the 1980s and 70s really tortured kids with all this nuclear annihilation talk. Like, it really wasn't, I don't think it was necessary, because it's not like, I've always, there's the very funny bit from an early season, like first season of South Park, I think, where they're talking about how if a volcano blows up, you should duck and cover. And it's kids like ducking and covering under their desk, and then the lava going over them and turning them into skeletons immediately. Like, that's all duck and cover is. Like, I don't even know why you would bother teaching children how to survive Just be like, if it happens, it happens. Oh, I don't know.
This was not, we're going to teach you how to survive. This is just letting you know that if the fascists,
the fires,
this nuclear war things happen, you're all going to die horribly.
Speaking of, I saw the trailer for Oppenheimer, the new trailer for Oppenheimer played in front of the Covenant.
Oh, really?
I don't know
how excited are you to have Barbie 3X the opening weekend gross of Oppenheimer?
Well,
are you going to be, you will be moved to,
I don't think it's going to be 3X, but I think it's definitely going to, it will outgross Oppenheimer, certainly. But what's interesting is that the tracking on Barbie is very interesting. The unaided awareness is very high, but the interest is very low, which is a real problem for the studio.
I heard this on your other podcast,
Bullwark Goes to Hollywood. Anyway, just shilling for all my podcasts here. Go live across the movie aisle, Tuesday, May 16th, 7:30, Draft House, Crystal City, 7:30, War Games.
$7.
It's only $7. Come on. I mean, there are only 14 tickets left. So again, we're taping this on Tuesday night. It might be sold out by the time. It sold out real quick. People excited to see War Games for $7. But on the Bulwark Goes to Hollywood, I was talking to David Heron of The Quorum, and he was saying that the tracking numbers are very interesting because unaided awareness very high on Barbie, but interest is very low, which is a real problem. Like if you have a mismatch like that, it suggests that there is that's harder to overcome than there being an equal amount of awareness and interest, because you can always create awareness. You just spend money on advertising.
The trailers for it have been very bad.
The trailers have been so bad.
Who is the movie for? Is it for adults?
Great question.
Girl bosses.
Because
great question.
Like the one I have seen like rolling in front of, I don't know, YouTube ads or YouTube videos. It's like Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie. And there's like a joke about how he wants to spend the night with her. And she's like, what would we do? And he's like, I don't know. And it's like, get it? Because they don't have genitals, because they're dolls. And I'm like, is this not for little girls? Because that is not a little kid joke at all.
And what's the joke at the end? It's like, beach off. We're doing a
maybe.
I press
skip ad at that point.
Yeah. I don't.
All right. So listen, Mike, you were not around for this, but I have shilled for this before. There is a very bizarre animated series called Barbie Life in the Dream House.
Oh, I've heard I'm well aware of your shilling for this show.
They're like 4-minute bits,
right,
and they are genius. And I can already tell they're going to be 5 times better than anything in this movie.
It really looks terrible, but it is going to gross more than Oppenheimer, I'm sure, which will be fairly disappointing because we are a fallen people and we deserve
You bad loved
things.
The show Girls, then you're going to love Barbie the movie.
No, but that's not, but like Girls is, did you watch Girls? You didn't watch Girls, JBL, because it was on HBO. But Girls is actually like an incredibly, I am sympathetic to the argument that Girls is actually a reactionary portrait of modern life.
This is Ross Douthat's point. Yes.
JBL is currently throwing things at the screen right now, but this is the Douthatian position, which is that basically it is like a portrait of the absolute emptiness of modern millennial life, a portrait of a generation in crisis. It was the opposite in a weird way of Sex and the City. It was not like an empowerment thing at all. It was like, these people live awful, terrible lives. So, which I don't think that's what Barbie's going to be like, but I don't know.
We'll see. Mm. All right. Well, the only thing,
Mike, how was your weekend?
The only thing I have to mention about my weekend, I feel like we buried the lead here, but I got to give it to the old school original listeners of the original show here. This weekend, I laid some mulch.
Oh, yeah.
The mulch
king.
Man cometh.
All right.
What kind of mulch?
I've showed a little leg here. Let's move on, I think.
What?
There's nothing. There's nothing else to say, really. It was mulch. It was mulch. There's nothing else to say.
Which kind? What was it? Colored?
Oh yeah, it was brown.
Colored mulch.
It was.
I don't think
it was.
You can say that.
It was dark brown mulch. But delivered in. Okay, so I will say this about my mulch delivery. So we have done it both ways. We have gotten bags before, and we've gotten the giant pile dumped on our driveway.
The yard of mulch?
Yeah, exactly. The
cubic yard.
Yeah, cubic yard. Yeah, all of that. This year, I think we did it the right way, which was we had bags delivered on like a giant pallet, and they're still sitting. Yes, because the thing is, and of course, with like our situation where we've got baseball every weekend, we've got, you know, a newborn baby still, or all, you know, I guess moving into no longer newborn, but still a needy baby. Like, I don't know when we're going to finish everything. So like, throw a few bags of mulch on when we can, and then like, we'll try again next weekend. So that's what we did. So this is our first weekend doing it. We did the front beds. You know, here's the problem. I live on a cul-de-sac, which is great. Every single house that is on our cul-de-sac is occupied by at least one person, and most of them by two people who do not have regular jobs. They're all retired. There's one stay-at-home wife. And so, like, they have all the time in the world. In fact, one of our neighbors, our retired neighbors, like, we're out there, like, just try, like, given the big boys, like, just, you know, make work jobs. Yeah, go move all the weeds that I threw over there in that pile into this other pile, sort of thing. And, you know, and she comes over and she's like, I don't know how you guys have the time to do all this. And we're like looking up at her like, yeah, like that's exactly why our yard looks like shit and everybody else's yard looks great. We're trying to make it work. Okay, lady. So, you know, it was, there's nothing much to say except like,
was it like a passive aggressive thing? Was she
No. It was meant in just the kindest, you know, spirit, but it was a additional indication that some neighbors around us,
they notice,
don't, no, not even that, just don't have a full awareness of what it's like anymore to have like a bunch of young kids running around, you know, like they sort of like it was almost like it was dawning on her like, oh gosh, like you actually, like, you know, you both work, you have these kids, you like have all this stuff, and like, I don't know how you have time to like make your yard look nice. You know, it was just kind of this like in the moment realization. So, you know, we're making do.
You know, in Texas, you could legally shoot her under stand your ground laws.
It wasn't aggressive. Believe me, if there are plenty of other aggressive things that have been said, that I could maybe, use that law. No, it's fine. It's nice. It's everybody's very kind about it in the cul-de-sac. So,
How many bags
did we spread, or how many bags?
No,
did we
how
have?
Many bags did you buy?
Gosh, I have to go back and check because I got it like in bulk.
50,
70, I think.
Seven.
Yeah, I think
how
it's
much
about
do you
70.
Pay for 70 bags of mulch?
I'll tell you. I'm efforting this right now.
Because that's what I'm curious about, is what the price differential is for getting it bagged versus the dump.
70 bags, it cost us less than $350.
$5 a bag?
Yeah.
It's a steal. It's the mulch steal of the year.
When you get it in bulk, when you get it in bulk like that. But it's just...
Did you order it from Lowe's?
No. I ordered it from a local landscape supply.
Gotcha.
So,
gotcha.
Yeah. So, so it was mulching all on Sunday. It was wonderful. It was great. And
mulch.
Is there anything else we can say about mulch? Is there mulch? Because I just say mulch a few more times just to give the fans fans something.
Mulch,
all right.
Mulch. That's what the people are chanting right now in their cars. Mulch. Mulch. Mulch.
Well, if that's the case, let's move on, shall we, gentlemen? Let's talk about the box office. Everybody's done with mulch. Okay. The box office this past weekend, Super Mario Brothers movie remains at the top, continues to super smash the competition, ranking at number one, getting just under $60 million in this last week. Their total domestic gross is something like $430-something million. It's huge. Just behind Super Mario Brothers movie is Evil Dead Rise, Coming in at number three is the movie we're talking about tonight, Guy Ritchie's The Covenant. I should be careful. Guy Ritchie's The Covenant. Number four, John Wick Chapter 4. Number five, Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves. Super Mario still at the top. Any box office thoughts before we dive into that number three movie, Guy Ritchie's The Covenant?
I mean, I think what's interesting with Super Mario Brothers, I mean, it dropped 35% in its second weekend, which is an amazing hold. Amazing. Again, this movie's going to gross $600 million probably. It's doing very good.
Because it's so good.
Box office, it's the people love it. The people love it. Evil Dead Rise ticked up all weekend. It was tracking around a little under 20 million. It ended up, the early projections were 22. It ended up at 24, which again, just it's interesting though. Like, I'm not breaking any news here, but the things that do well at the box office are franchises and things that have high name recognition and high ID. So something like Super Mario Brothers or Evil Dead Rise. I mean, it's interesting to compare Evil Dead Rise to The Pope's Exorcist or Renfield, both of which grossed about $9 million in their opening weekends. There is a market for franchises and things that are franchise like, and it is it's kind of tough sledding for everything else, including The Covenant, which has its own weird box office history here, but you know,
how many screens was The Covenant on?
It got a wide release. It was on 3,000.
My
theater, 2600.
It was on only a single screen at my theater, and it was at a very small screen.
Yes, yeah. Same with me.
It's on 2600 screens in its opening weekend. It will probably be, I would guess it's probably on about the same this weekend, and then it's going to fall to like 800 on its third weekend, because I would assume there's some sort of tax incentive here. Most of the way these things are structured is if you're going to get a tax break on a movie, you need to be in a certain number of screens. I would guess the number is probably 2,500 screens, if I had to, I had to guess. But this movie and Guy Ritchie's previous movie, which came out like a month ago, I don't think we even talked about it. Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre. Remember?
Yes.
Remember Guy Ritchie's?
We did not talk about it.
Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre, that came out a month ago. Both of these were movies that were produced under the STX label. STX, of course, was a movie production fund that was heavily funded, I believe, by China, and they are kind of getting out of the Western cinema game because it is not working for them. They are not they can't figure out how to make it work. But it was also an MGM movie, which of course MGM just bought by Amazon. Like, there's a whole weird thing there. Nobody quite knows. Nobody at Amazon really wants to do anything with the stuff for MGM that was already made, which creates all sorts of problems. But you know, this movie, like Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre, opened up on probably more screens than it should have for how much awareness there is of the movie. And like Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre is going to kind of die at the box office here because there's no real advertising campaign for it. There's no awareness, and it's too bad because it's a good movie, right, guys?
Right. Yeah. Let's get into it. Wait, before we get into it though, question, because I do wonder this is box office related. The Guy Ritchie, appendage at the front of this movie. I understand there was another movie, right? A horror movie called The Covenant or something. But like, is there a box office reason? Is there a marketing reason as well for adding this to the front?
That's a really interesting question. And I would be very curious to know how exactly this came about, because Guy Ritchie is frankly not a box office draw. He just isn't. If you look at basically everything he has made, excluding Aladdin, which grossed $1 billion because it was a live action Disney movie. If you look at pretty much everything else he has done, it is underperformed relative to, I think, what people might have expected. Wrath of Man and The Gentlemen are kind of came out in a weird situation because it was like The Gentlemen came out like the last weekend before the pandemic, or like two weekends before the pandemic. Yep. And Wrath of Man was one of the first big movies to get a release post-pandemic. You know, it was still pandemic era. There were still, like, lots of theaters were still closed, etc. So those movies, not a super fair comparison point,
right.
You know, trying to figure out what exactly his box office draw is. But I mean, I would say, as somebody who really likes lots of Guy Ritchie movies, not all of them, but lots of them, he frequently underperforms. I mean, remember Chav King Arthur?
Yes,
we discussed
course.
On the show. I mean, that movie was supposed to be the start of a whole cinematic universe, a whole Chav King Arthur universe, with all the Knights of the Round Table getting individual entries, and that movie just bombed spectacularly. It was not a people were not into it, were interested, and that is, I think, more common than not in his box office history. I mean, look at The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which did okay,
right.
not spectacular, not terrible, but just okay. At a time when lots of things were doing really well in that sort of space.
Right.
So
the problem is his movies are too good for the people.
I think that is at least partly right. true. I'm not kidding.
No, I agree.
No,
I agree.
I agree.
Yeah, I just know that when I saw this movie and I texted my friends about it, again, 35-year-old males, it's anecdata. It was all like, oh yeah, I've heard of that movie. I you know, because of the Guy Ritchie connection. You know, it was like, again, it was a higher awareness than I predicted, but it was because of the Guy Ritchie thing, right?
I mean, I think Guy Ritchie is a name that movie fans will recognize, even if they aren't necessarily going to show up for his stuff. I mean, I like Snatch was very popular.
Yes.
Certainly amongst a certain males who were, you know, between the age of 15 and 25, you know, in 2000. I think he is a name that people recognize, but I don't think it's not like Steven Spielberg or right. Christopher Nolan.
No, it's like, more like Wes Anderson.
Yeah, but I think even Wes Anderson has a slightly better track record. He's also Wes Anderson's also working on a slightly lower budget level,
yeah.
I think, than
yeah.
But I love Guy Ritchie. I mean, look, we'll get to the proper review of The Covenant here in a few minutes at minute maybe 40. We're already at 30.
I mean, or you could just launch into it now, Sonny. I had so many questions.
But no. But what I really love about Guy Ritchie's recent work is he's released four. There have been four Guy Ritchie movies in the last 4 years, right? There was The Gentleman in 2020, Wrath of Man in 2021, I think, or maybe 2022, and then in the last month here, you've had
two.
Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre, and The Covenant. And all four of these movies are very, very different. They're all very different pictures. He has, you know, kind of his classic Guy Ritchie British gangster movie with The Gentleman. Wrath of Man is like a 1970s... Guy Ritchie's Heat is one way to think of it, but I like almost more of like a 1970s almost grindhousey crime thriller type movie, just like a really brutal film. Actually, it's like a very it's almost hard to watch in places. It is just very intense and violent in a way that his movies really hadn't been up to that point. Then you have Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre, which is kind of like a James Bond spoof type movie. A lot of fun. I liked it a lot. And then this movie, which is a very straightforward, arguably the most earnest movie he has ever made, the least irony soaked, the most earnest movie he has ever made, straightforward war film. Like this is a movie that I would expect to come from somebody like what's his name, Peter Berg.
Yeah.
Right. This feels like a Peter Berg movie, not
Guy Ritchie's Black
Guy
Hawk
Ritchie
Down.
Movie. Yeah, or like a Black Hawk Down, and it's great. It's really, really good. So Jake Gyllenhaal stars as a staff sergeant in Afghanistan. He is out doing some trying to blow up an IED factory with his guys. He's got a new interpreter with him who knows the country really well, and he like takes charge of certain situations, which Jake Gyllenhaal's sergeant kind of resents a little bit, but like also understands that this guy knows what he's doing. He's competent. They go out to blow up this IED factory, and the Taliban shows up and His whole squadron gets killed, and the interpreter gets him back to safety. Now that's the setup. Like that, all of this is in the first minute of the trailer. So I feel like I'm not really spoiling anything, but it's also the first hour of the film. Like the first thing I was struck by in with this picture is kind of how it is structured and paced. This whole section, what is essentially the setup for the way the movie has been pitched, which is Jake Gyllenhaal returns to Afghanistan to rescue his interpreter from the Taliban. That's only like the last 25 minutes of the movie, which is wild to me. I don't know if you guys were expecting it to be paced differently or structured differently than it is, but it was like it is not a movie that is strictly speaking about Jake Gyllenhaal trying to rescue his interpreter, even though that is what it is about. It is about the interpreter saving this guy's life at very great risk to himself, to his family, et cetera, et cetera. Again, the way I describe this movie is it's the most earnest, least irony drenched Guy Ritchie film ever made. And I think that is because there's a simmering anger under the, under the surface here, a frustration that I frankly share with the writer and the director about how America treated the Afghan interpreters and allies in the closing months and years of that conflict. And as JBL says, we might get into this a little bit more, but the movie it most reminded me of as I was watching it was Lone Survivor. Did you guys see Lone Survivor, the Peter Berg movie? Yep. But it's the story of Marcus Luttrell.
Yes.
Marcus Luttrell, Michael Murphy, Danny Dietzen, and Matthew Axelson, who were just a squad of soldiers in Afghanistan who tracked down a high value target. Ended up getting chased by the Taliban through the mountains. They sent out it's a crazy part of the movie because I remember the crash of the helicopter team that went to go see them. I remember reading about this and thinking, oh my God, this is horrible. They killed like 20 guys died in this rescue attempt. But in the movie, it's played as like the climactic swelling. Here comes the cavalry to save everybody, and then the helicopter crashes into a mountain. It's like, oh fuck, that's not good. I love that movie, and I like this movie for similar reasons, which is that it is a pretty straightforward tale of heroism and sacrifice and difficulty and duty and honor and is just really well done, really straightforward, stylish without being showy. For the most part, and really well acted. I mean, I texted you guys after I got out of the theater. I was like, oh wait, that Johnny Lee Miller plays the colonel in this movie, and he looks like a 40-year-old colonel. I was like, oh, I feel a billion years old because I remember Johnny Lee Miller from Hackers and Trainspotting.
Scottish accent. That was the through
junkie kid, and you know, now he's the figure of authority. He was also John Major in the last season of The Crown. I don't know. Anyway, I like this movie a lot. It's really well done. Everything about it is great. Curious to see what you guys made of it.
So JV, I'll come to you in just a second, but because you brought it up, Sonny, the pacing and structure of the movie, I was trying to think about what it felt like, and it felt like a short story, in the structure where a short story often feels like crams a lot of information into a short story, and something about the kind of, there's almost episodic structure of it. You know, there's like the first part where the IED team, you know, kind of comes together, and then and they go out to the site that they suspect of being an IED factory or whatever, and then it all goes to shit. Like that's like an episode, and then the sort of march through the wilderness that the interpreter and Jake Gyllenhaal take, you know, like that's another episode, and then the end, which you would think that's what the entire movie is. I went into this cold. I had no idea what the movie was really even about, except an Afghan interpreter, and so but like that last part is its own episode. It sort of like had this kind of I don't know. I don't know why I think of short story, but it just had this this structure that reminded me of it. It also, like, it's 2 hours long, and it did not feel 2 hours long. It felt like it really kind of like whizzed by as well. Maybe that's, you know, contributing to my sense of this as being a short story. And so it felt different watching it. Like, it just felt like a different kind of movie, not just a different kind of Guy Ritchie movie. I don't feel like you see a lot of movies plotted and structured that way.
Well, I mean, if you went through this movie and broke it down scene by scene, with the exception of part of that bit in the middle where they're after Jake Gyllenhaal's character has been injured and his interpreter is taking him back to the base, every individual scene conveys a piece of information. I mean, every individual scene, it's a very well written movie. It's very well structured on a moment by moment basis, because every time you stop in a place for more than a minute, you're learning something about the characters or the situation. So the movie opens with this. Essentially, they're at a checkpoint. The squadron's initial interpreter is there, and he's trying to figure out what's going on with a truck that has stopped and a couple people die. He gets blown up. One of the guys gets blown up. And you learn in that like 5 minutes. Okay, these are the dangers. These are the stakes. Here's where everybody is. And then as the film progresses with the new interpreter, you see him behave in a manner that is both competent and confident. That was not present with the first interpreter. He's just better at his job. Right.
He's not just translating, kind of he's interpreting, right? And that's
right. So, anyway,
I loved it. JVL, I would love to hear your thoughts, because I have other thoughts, but I want to know what you thought, because you saw it first and you were like blown away.
Yeah, I thought it was a very powerful movie. I should lay my cards on the table. This is something. The plight of Afghanistan and Afghani interpreters is something that has been on my mind a lot, because we've run a bunch of pieces from the Bulwark about it. I have a friend who spent a lot of time over there, who has been involved in literally the exact type of thing that the movie ends with, which is these off the books extractions. He has been involved in that. There's a whole universe of guys who are current military and former military who serve there, who, you know, like, they've stayed in touch with their interpreters. And when everything started going to shit 2 years ago, they sprang into action to do everything they could. And now they're, anyway, it's a horrifying breach of American honor in what we did. But the movie itself is fantastic. And it is the tension that exists throughout, as you say, Sonny, the doling out of information scene by scene, and the sense of geography about it is, I think, what impressed me most. Mm. In that, no matter what's happening, you always know exactly where you are in the movie, whether in the macro sense of, you know, how far you are from Bagram, or are you on a hill or in a valley. Or even just when you get to the firefights. So, you know, when you wind up at the checkpoint, right? Guy Ritchie establishes very clearly, like, where is this checkpoint? Where are the soldiers? Where are the cars lined up? So that when things happen, you understand them. And this is a trademark of Ridley Scott action set pieces, right? You know, Ridley Scott always makes sure that everybody understands where everything is as action is happening. And when the squad eventually gets ambushed and killed at the IED factory, that scene, which again is a very Black Hawk Down scene, you understand where every member of that team is, right? You understand where the Taliban members are coming from. I just think it's one of the best war movies I've ever seen.
It's really, really well done. Again, the action beats are all exceptionally good. And I was saying this before we got before we got started here. There's a movie that this reminds me of a little bit is because it's not based on a true story. This is not like Lone Survivor. This is correct. This is a fictionalized story. And what this movie reminds me a little bit of is like Rambo 2. First Blood Part 2, mm-hmm. right? Which is essentially the American cinematic industrial complex being like, this time we're going to win Vietnam. We're gonna send Rambo in there. We're gonna get our guys out, and the POW flags are gonna come down because we're gonna get them all out. It's gonna be great. And there's a certain amount of as JVL says, this is a thing that happens. This is not totally, you know, out of the realm of possibility, all of everything in this movie happening. But like, there's a title card at the end that says, you know, 300 have been killed already. Murdered, thousands more living in hiding out of fear of retribution from the Taliban who have retaken the country. That is the reality of the story. The reality is not Jake Gyllenhaal parachuting into Afghanistan and going undercover and getting his guy out for the most part. It happens for the most part. That is not the reality. The reality is these guys are getting fucking murdered and their families are getting killed, and you can't tell that story. I mean, like that's not a pleasing story, no matter how true it is. So you instead get this, which is sort of, again, like, this time we're gonna do it right. This time we're gonna get the guys out who deserve to get out.
Has anyone interpreted the final act of this movie in the same way that, Sonny, you interpreted Top Gun Maverick, which is that the end is like a fantasy sequence within the context of the movie?
He's dead on the bridge, you mean?
No, I mean before, but he dies I mean the sort of before he even goes there, right? I mean, just I'm making this up on the fly. I don't know. This is not a sophisticated theory here or anything, but, you know, just thinking
I don't think that really works. It doesn't make much sense. But
there is a fantasy element to it, right? Is your point?
Well, there's a Hollywood element to it, right? Which is like, there's this great, you know, spoilers, I guess. There's this great moment where they're in a shootout on the bridge. Really, seriously, spoilers. If you want to go see the movie, you don't want to just turn off the episode. Jake Gyllenhaal takes his guy to this extraction point. He's got the family there, and they're waiting for these contractors to show up with their helicopter to extract him and get him out of there. But they're pinned down on the bridge, and they're out of ammo, and the Taliban are coming down the pike, and, you know, he's taking his last breath and he's looking around, and all of a sudden the fucking AC-130 Spectre gunship shows up and blows everybody up. And it's just awesome. It's one of the purest expressions of American propaganda I've seen on film in a long time. I loved it. I love just mm-hmm. like this. There's a shot of the AC-130 gunship as it goes across. It's just US Air Force across the side of it.
It's beautiful.
Coming in as the savior of these guys, and, you know, superior American firepower. There's something to be said for it. I could see thinking that moment is kind of dreamlike, but it's just Hollywood storytelling.
Yes. Again, maybe it's not actually, but it does have this sort of, you know, as you were saying, an alternative history element to it, you know, and there's a metaphor here in terms of, you know, what if the United States, you know, actually did this for its, for the Afghan interpreters, you know, actually did come in and save the day.
Yeah.
Can I say also, like, for somebody who's been, been watching war movies since I was a kid, you know, and then in the post 9/11 era, that have such a heavy-handed politicalness to them that they're just like hard to watch. If like you go back and watch some of those old, like, you know, post 9/11, like, you know, Robert Redford war movies or whatever. It's just like so didactic. And for an extremely pointed movie, you know, or, you know, a movie, as you said, that like the writer and the director here are clearly angry and enraged about this, it wears that politicalness so lightly and in a way where you feel the outrage because of the story you've just seen.
Yeah.
Not because you've been lectured to feel the outrage.
Well, there's a similar thing happens in Michael Bay's Benghazi movie, 13 Hours.
Yes.
Which is a movie that could have been a much more political thing, as you say. As could have been the case here, but what it is, the way the politics come through is just the complete absence of action, the complete the way bureaucracy kind of bungles everything and gets everything bogged down in incompetence and failure. That is the political angle here more than anything else. It is not a
It's not directed at a president or anything like that. Yeah,
right. To the extent that the
bureaucracy.
Yeah,
right. But I mean, two other things I wanted to say. One, which is a screenwriting credit, really. So when Jake Gyllenhaal's character, our protagonist, the reason he goes back to rescue his interpreter is not because he and his interpreter were best friends, not because they were close. It's literally because he can't not do it because he feels so indebted. And there's a scene where he's talking to it's not like, this is my friend and you've got to get him out. He's talking to the colonel and he says, I have this hook in me and I've tried every way I can to not have it, but it's there. Right. And the only way to take this hook out is to repay my debt. And that's a really nice way of not sentimentalizing the movie.
Yes.
I mean, maybe it's sentimental in a different way, but it's not in the obvious way. The other thing that I think was pretty sophisticated is that the movie, without making a show of it, does a very, very deft job of explaining why America lost in Afghanistan. And it, you know, I think it's a Vietnam adage, right? You know, you have the watches, but we have the time. Right. And that, you know, America has predator drones everywhere, and so the American squad that might be going to an ambush is able to call up in 30 seconds from their Humvees aerial footage from a predator drone, which seems like this amazing advantage until you realize that the Taliban have 2 million people with cell phones just walking around on the street, so that no matter where you are, there is some Taliban sympathizer who's got headphones in and a cell phone who can just call in your position. Right. And that the weird thing about the Afghans is that for a bunch of, especially for the Taliban, illiterate, uneducated country bumpkins, these people have been fighting wars on and off for 400 years. Right. They are not unsophisticated warriors. And the Taliban commanders understand how to lay ambushes and how, you know, like,
Well, and they also understand population control and the usefulness of savagery.
Yeah, yeah, the movie makes all of that plain. It also makes plain the desolation of Afghanistan. Right, it's a really large country, but with the population is you have two population centers basically, and everything else is spread out, and you can't control that country. A country that's just spread out like that, and you know, so total population of Afghanistan is 40 million people. Of those, about 10 million, give or take, are fighting age men. No matter how many troops America was going to put in there, that country has 10 million men who are capable of fighting. Like, you can't, you just can't do that, right? You cannot successfully win a conflict in that way. Anyway, it's great. People should see it.
Can I say on the movie making front of kind of making that point, or just the point of this sort of relentlessness of the Taliban, You know, I don't know, like my unsophisticated sort of way of judging these things is like, especially when I'm in a theater, is like, how are people reacting? And there was a couple and their other female friend were sitting next to me at the Alamo Drafthouse. And there was at some point, like, you know, I can't remember what it was, but there were like 20 scenes like this where like another, you know, 15 Taliban guys, you know, with machine guns, like run over the hill.
Show up in a truck.
Yeah, show up in a truck or like run over the hill or whatever it was. And like at some point, the two ladies who were with there, with one of them with their husband, they just went, oh, like, oh no, like another one. You know, there was just this kind of like, they had so been captured, I think, by the hopelessness, the feeling of hopelessness that image, you know, kept sending. Cause it was almost like video game, you know, it was like, oh, here's another bunch of baddies. Like have come over the hill. I thought that was,
no, they're fucking sadistic animals.
Yeah.
And, I'm sorry. Maybe I shouldn't talk that way about other human beings, but
okay. Now Taliban, you can get away with it.
It's all right, I think. Well, this is also how I feel about Black Hawk Down, but I would not get into my feelings when I watch wave after wave of Somali come after the Black Hawk Down guys. One last filmmaking note to get away from politics and back to the movie. The score of this movie is fantastic. The kind of deep strings, a cello or whatever that is, that the composer's playing.
Of Chav King Arthur, actually.
Well, so the guy who composed this is Christopher Benstead, who has worked with Ritchie. Now, I don't think he worked with him on Chav King Arthur. Hold on, let me look that up real quick. So Benstead has worked with Guy Ritchie now on his last four movies, The Covenant, Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre, Wrath of Man, and The Gentleman. And Wrath of Man is where it most, where this specific kind of sound most kicks in. It really contributes to the sense of dread and like oppressive tension in that film. And it does the same thing here. It just is. It's a really wonderful piece of composition and scoring. And, I think that the Ritchie Benstead, pairing has been tremendously good for the, emotional resonance of Guy Ritchie's last four pictures. And I really wish more people would see them. I mean, going back to The Gentleman is very good in the kind of classic Guy Ritchie British gangster movie role mold, but I think that his masterpiece from this stretch is Wrath of Man. Still, as much as I like The Covenant, which I think is very good, but Wrath of Man I think is like a genuine cinema of brutality masterpiece that more folks should see. I think it's on Prime Video.
And his real masterpiece is Chav King Arthur, but that's okay.
No, that's not true. Don't listen to JBL.
You know. I thought the political talk might blow up, but clearly the Chav King Arthur talk is what we need to stay away from. All right.
This is long running.
Well, we're going to end it there for the night, but thanks for listening again. Subbeacon.com. You can subscribe, comment, listen, tell us what you think of the show. Follow Sunny Bunch at Sunny Bunch on Twitter. You're still on Twitter. Yes.
At Sunny Bunch.
You can follow me still at Michael R. Warren, and we will see you next time.
So we ended up doing like a weird thing where we talked about Jake Gyllenhaal for like 20 minutes.
It wasn't that weird.
It was. We talked a lot about like his muscles and his
the eyes,
blue eyes.
Remember Southpaw when he got real like roided
you're getting
up.
You're getting us started on this again, Sonny. Don't get us started.
He's roided up for something else. I saw production photos of him roided up in some new movie.
Roadhouse. Yeah, because he's like a UFC guy.
Yeah,
in Roadhouse.
He looks like he's down to like 0.5% body fat.
Anyway, we talk about Jake Gyllenhaal for a bunch in the bonus episode this week, and you can listen to that. That'll be up on Monday. So,
sure.
Anyway, until then, sure it's fine.